Hello, everyone. We're back with Three Prong Podcast, and today we've got another very interesting guest. But as our usual fashion, which hasn't featured in a few of our last episodes because we recorded them a while back, is our good, bad, and ugly segment. But today, because we need some positivity, I think we've all got a good. I think so. I think we should start with you, Chris.
Right, well, yeah, and a good for me, actually, going back to one of the first podcasts, and very topical for tonight's guest, I was explaining how sad it was that our local abattoir, Black Brow, up in Cumbria, had closed, and was meaning, quite a longer trip for myself, and as many people know, there's a hell of a lot of animals in Cumbria, and a lot of people, especially out of COVID, created their own businesses to sell meat direct to the consumer from farm. Well, the good news is it has reopened, and they are investing in it. It's a business who have various different abattoirs and cutting plants over the UK. They are doing halal slaughter. It's brilliant for me, and I think it's they're opening a door, they're investing in the plant, making it better, in more employment for local people, and really seem to be giving it a good go. So great to see, and I hope that other abattoirs maybe reopen as well, because I think it's been a bit of a downward spiral, but this is a bit of positivity, so good.
You're up, Neil.
My good's probably a bit of a selfish good then. So I was really fortunate a couple of weeks ago to get the opportunity to hop on a plane and go to Florida and talk at a conference about cattle hoof trimming, which was a real pleasure to be able to go and really showcase what we do in the UK, because we have some of the highest standards in the world, really, around the guys that are trimming the cows' feet in this country. So it was a great honour to go across America and talk to them about what we're doing, and hopefully they are going to use our blueprint to sort of move on what they do there. But it's certainly a tough nut to crack, the Americans. They're pretty steadfast in their ways and very, very opinionated, but hopefully it's that they are seeing the benefits of having a sort of structure in place.
Does it differ that much then? The UK way of doing it to America, chalk and cheese or?
No, there's not a lot of difference in how you trim a cow's foot. It's just we've got a lot of qualifications available and a little bit of regulation around what we do. So, for example, if you're a farmer selling to Sainsbury's, the guy coming onto the farm trimming the cows has to be a member of an association and has to be sort of qualified to be able to do that. So that's really good. So supermarkets like Sainsbury's and M&S doing a similar thing, and it won't be long before sort of Tesco's follow as well. And they're the people that are sort of pushing it. Whereas America, it's still a bit of the Wild West, unfortunately, but there is that talk there within their food industry that they're getting more consumer pressure to sort of improve animal welfare.
I definitely did not know hoof trimming went that deep. I thought you just trim the foot, let the cow walk nicely, and that's it. My good this week is it was my first time today going to a livestock market as a seller. I've always gone to livestock markets with friends and taken other people's animals, but I've never taking my own, and I don't know how people deal with that pressure, because as soon as I got there and I knew I was waiting for them to sell, you don't know how much you're going to sell, even though the price is quite good for sheep at the moment. My heart was beating so hard when we got to the pen my sheep were in, but luckily my friend, my other friend, another Chris, he was selling his sheep as well, so he took care of the standing in the pen and sort of telling people what the sheep were doing. So yeah, that's definitely a farming highlight today, and hopefully going again next week, and the market breakfast, which was really good.
Did you just sort of say you were lost for words?
What's that?
Well, you wouldn't stand in the pen. Like, I thought you'd be.
Oh, mate. No. Well, it's my first time on the market. I was thinking, I don't want to be jinxing this price. So I just stood, there, but I was just quiet. Whether people knew I had shit in there as well.
There and go and say, do you know who I am? I have been on television. You want these sheep?
I stand out as it is. Actually, there was two black guys there, me and my mate Dylan. So I did. I've got dreads; he doesn't. So I still stand out. But I wasn't saying much. Right. So to introduce our guest, I think we're getting a fair few highbrow guests lately. Had a MD last week. We got a doctor this week. We got Dr. Awa Fuseni, a fellow African, but from the West Side. He is the senior halal sector manager at AHDB. He's also an author and a fellow podcaster. So hopefully we can get some tips from you. And your topic of interest is mainly animal welfare, particularly halal slaughter, among other things. So, yeah, we're looking forward to picking your brains on this. And, yeah, Ramadan Mubarak.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about yourself, man.
Sorry?
I said, tell us a bit more about yourself.
Yeah, so, well, as you said, thank you very much for the invite. It's a privilege to be here, to be able to share some thoughts around halal with you guys. I'm a senior halal sector manager at the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. My background is in animal welfare and meat science. I did my master's and PhD in Bristol University. My PhD actually involved the slaughter of adult cattle. My master's was on general meat science, so we did a lot of stuff on meat science, and I did a dissertation looking at post-mortem data in a beef abattoir. So both my PhD and my master's have got something to do with cattle.
So have you stayed with just sort of focusing on cattle, or have you ventured out with sheep and goats? Obviously, being a Muslim, listeners, I don't know, you don't consume pork, so those are probably your main focuses.
Yeah. So in terms of my research area, it was in cattle. But I've written a lot on poultry and also on small ruminants. And at the minute, with the halal sector, as you know, or as people may know, it accounts for a vast majority of small ruminant slaughter. So at the minute, in my current role, I focus a lot on small ruminants, but I do a bit on beef slaughter as well.
For listeners that don't know, what makes meat halal?
Okay, that's a very good question. So there are, if you're looking at the requirements of halal meat production, there are three ways you can look at it. So the person bleeding the animal, the animal you are slaughtering, the type of animal you're slaughtering, and the knife you're using to slaughter the animal. So first, let's look at the animal you're slaughtering. Not all animals can be slaughtered as halal. So pigs, for instance, that's a classic example of animals that cannot be slaughtered for halal. Carnivorous animals, any carnivorous animal cannot be slaughtered for halal consumption. Poultry, small ruminants and large ruminants are all accepted, including pseudo ruminants like camels. So in terms of the acceptable animals, those are the acceptable and the forbidden animals. Now, the animal at the point of slaughter must be alive. And it's always you have to be careful when you are saying the animal should be alive, because there's a difference between an animal being conscious or an animal being unconscious and an animal being alive. The difference is that if you stun an animal, you can stun an animal and the animal will be unconscious while still being alive. So that is why some Muslims accept stunning, because the rules are that the animals must be alive. So what their argument is that if you stun an animal and you don't use a lethal method of stunning, then that would be acceptable. So maybe we can come back to that later. Yeah. So that is in terms of the animal. The person bleeding the animal must be an adolescent, must recite a short prayer. And the short prayer is simply Bismillah. That means in the name of God. Some people say Bismillah, Allahu Akbar. So in the name of God, God is great, before the slaughter. It must be done before slaughter. And this has got some Christian or Jewish relation as well. So Christians, most practicing Christians, before they consume food, they'll do the grace. They'll say the grace to thank God for providing the food for them. That is very similar to Muslims. They thank God for providing an animal that they are about to take the life of. If you don't know these, some people will present it as if halal is a very ritualistic thing where people are singing and dancing when during slaughter. But that is not the case. There is a significance to the recitation of the prayer. And that is very similar to the grace that Christians do. The last bit is the knife you are using. The knife must be surgically sharp, and it must be at least twice the diameter of the neck. The reason for this is it must be long enough so that you can place it at one end of the neck and draw it to the other end in one swift movement. Sawing during halal slaughter is discouraged or is forbidden. So it's not good to be sawing during slaughter. It's good to do a one swift cut of the carotid arteries and jugular veins so that you can stop blood from reaching the brain. So in a nutshell, that's the explanation of halal slaughter.
Now that was a really good explanation. Just going on to something you said.
Yeah.
What percent of Muslims do accept stunning, roughly?
So that's a very interesting question. We did a study in 2017 where we interviewed Islamic scholars around the UK. We also interviewed halal consumers. When we started the conversation, we asked the scholars, if an animal is stunned and then slaughtered with according to the halal rules, will the meat be accepted? The majority of them said, no, the meat will not be accepted. However, when we changed the question and said, okay, if an animal is stunned and the method of stunning does not result in the death of the animal, would you accept the meat? 95% of the scholars said, if we can demonstrate to them that the method of stunning doesn't kill the animal, then the meat will be halal. That's why I say it's very tricky when you are having this discussion. You have to differentiate between an animal being unconscious and an animal being dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many animals in the UK are killed slaughtered doing that method that you've just spoken about? And how many are the more, say, traditional, where stunning, you know, like, where is that sitting?
Okay, that's another interesting question. And we only have data for England and Wales. We don't have data for Scotland. And the data from the Food Standards Agency showed that if you take the total throughput for England and Wales into consideration, halal slaughter accounts for 72.3% of the total small ruminants, so sheep and goats, 72% of the total animals that are slaughtered in England and Wales are slaughtered by the halal method. Large ruminants cattle, around 4% in England and Wales. So if you take the whole throughput that goes through abattoirs in England and Wales, cattle will be 4% that is done halal, and poultry will be 21%. So 72% for small ruminants, 4% for cattle, and 21% for poultry.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's massive numbers, isn't it, really?
It really is
huge. I didn't realise that the numbers around, sort of sheep and goats was that high.
Yes.
I mean, that really is staggering.
Yeah, so now you need to, when you're looking at the throughput values, you don't just look at only the throughput. You need to look at frequency of consumption and also amount of money that is spent on meat. So if we take Muslim consumers, for instance, Muslim consumers, around 62% of Muslims consume lamb at least once a week. 62% of Muslims. Compare this to the general population. It's only 6% of the general population that will consume lamb at some point during the week. So 62 against 6%. That's the frequency of consumption. Now let's move on to the amount of money that is spent on meat. Muslim households will spend £28.50 a week on meat against only £12.60 spent by the general population. That is huge. Yeah. I'll give you an example. Let me use myself, for instance. Last week, before we started Ramadan, I spent £40 on lamb and chicken. That was last week. Just before this podcast, 2 hours ago, I went to the shop and bought £49 worth of meat, lamb and chicken. So that is, I'm over indexing. I'm above the average. Because the average is saying £28.50. I'm spending not less than £40 on meat a week. But if you compare this, if I were to ask Chris or Neil, how much you spent you consume lamb in the last week, whether you consume mutton in the last month, you are likely to say no to mutton, because almost 100% of the mutton that is produced ends up in the Muslim community.
Yeah.
So the halal market is very important, but when we are discussing these things, people politicize it. It is an important market for farmers. If we take our time to look at the facts, it's very important, but it tends to be politicized.
That's a real shame, though, that it's politicized, isn't it? I mean, it's just, it's a real shame. And I think, you know, just listening to those numbers and those figures, it's like, and I was doing a little bit of research on yourself and some of the stuff you put out there and talking about that the size of the market there for British agriculture, for British farming. Really, British farming and agriculture should be just absolutely looking to maximise this market as much as we can.
Absolutely, yeah. Because without it, as I said, mutton, if I were to... Okay, Neil, this is a question for you. When was the last time you ate mutton?
I don't eat a lot of lamb or mutton, to be honest.
When I speak to people, I always try to ask them, when was the last time you ate it? And people will tell you, look, honestly, I haven't eaten it, but Muslims will eat it every day.
Yeah.
It's like, for example, I know the importance of the halal market, especially for lamb.
Yeah.
You go into a supermarket and you see these, I think we've been quite creative with steaks on beef and stuff like that. But very much on a supermarket shelf, lamb is your traditional roasting joints, mince, chops, which, like, I eat a lot, big lad, like, a lamb chop doesn't really fill me, especially compared to a pork chop. So, like, you just think we haven't been as creative as if you look at, like to New Zealand, there's lots of different ways that they balance the carcass better than sort of we do. So it's so crucial, in my opinion, that we tap into that market of someone that is actually championing British lamb. What I would say to you is, how can we encourage sort of farmers to get behind this sort of movement and the push towards halal slaughter and get them to be champions of who they're producing for?
So I speak to farmers across the country, and I always, you see, the trouble is there's a lot of misinformation about halal in the media. Whether in mainstream media or social media, there's a lot of misinformation. Now, because of that misinformation, farmers are scared of getting involved. Not until we take our time, as I said, give them the facts of the matter. And say, look, this is actually the case. This is what you find on internet. It's not a good representation of the halal market. Take New Zealand and Australia, for instance. Almost everything in Australia is halal. Almost 100% of their sheep is slaughtered halal. But we are not there yet. We are 70%. We need to embrace it. We need to understand the significance of the market. And we just need to speak the facts. No stories about what is going on when that is not the fact. Let's face the fact. Once we present the facts to farmers, they will become more receptive to the idea of halal slaughter.
I think that point there, also from a social element of it, we can see what politics is like in this country.
Yeah.
And when we've got an industry struggling, like today at the market, where the sheep price has been up for what? At least a month now or more? But yeah. Today I was just talking around there, sort of saying Easter's next weekend, sort of Eid is it first week of April?
Or it's around the 9th of April.
9th, yeah. So you think, okay, so after Easter we've got Eid, and after that, then what? People, like in this country, even me working as a butcher in a farm shop, you can see the peaks and troughs when people buy a lot of lamb. When it's Easter coming up, everyone wants to buy lamb. But then throughout the year, people don't eat lamb that much. Whereas, as you can say, a growing population in this country of Muslims want to eat lamb. But then you've got socially and politically, worldwide, not just in the UK, you have that agenda in the background that essentially Islamophobia, which is ruining it for an industry here. And I think a lot of people, aside from the propaganda, people go down the road of, but they're saying a prayer to my food. So hang on. How do you know that a baker doing sourdough in London or whatever doesn't say grace before doing your bread? You don't know that. And if you don't believe in a religion or that really, you don't follow a particular religion, why does it bother you? If someone wants to say Bismillah before slaughtering an animal because you want to say thanks, like for me, I'm brought up a Christian. Every time I've put down a pig, there's something I say within me, because it's an animal's life you take. You don't just look at an animal and go bang. There's something. I always pause for a second or two before I put the animal down. So this whole thing of propaganda and people saying, "Oh, you're praying on my food. I don't want you to pray on my food." I think again, it's back to the lack of knowledge and ignorance, really.
Yeah. Sorry, you go, Chris.
So you mentioned about in Australia being almost 100%. What have they done to make it more acceptable? And is there anything that we can learn from them?
So the Australians, what they've done is, if you go to the Middle East, the majority of all the majority of the products that are exported to the Muslim majority countries are either from Australia, New Zealand, or Brazil, and countries like that. The Australians have been marketing their products as halal for a long time, and this is what they how they do it. They stun all their animals.
Yeah.
Before halal slaughter. But what they then do is that they've got what they call demonstration of recovery. So they've got a facility to invite Muslims into the abattoir. They stun the animal to show the animal the Muslims that the method of stunning they're using is not lethal. It's not going to kill the animal. So they have a mechanism to demonstrate to the Muslim community that their method does not kill the animal. That allays fear of some Muslims that all stunning methods kill. I know there are still some stunning methods that will kill captive bull, penetrative captive bull stunning, for instance, will destroy the brain and will kill the animal. But they are using head-only electrical stunning. And the same thing that we are using here, head-only electrical stunning for our small ruminants. We have tried to do to mimic what they are doing by introducing what is called demonstration of life in the UK. So there is now a facility in the UK where abattoirs can actually participate. The FSA will come in with the Muslim community to do the demonstration, so that you can demonstrate to them that, look, the method of stunning you are using doesn't kill. So but the Australians have been doing it for decades.
Okay.
That's amazing that they
do. It is. I mean, going back to being like what Flav was saying and like the whole public perception, because there is a sort of negative, there is a negative public perception. You know, you say to somebody about halal and the first thing they think is all you do. is obviously just, you know, slitting a cat, you know, an animal's throat. And obviously, does there need to be more of a line? And I'm saying this from a really naive point of view, so I'm trying to be naive, like, sometimes, that, you know, you've got kosher, which, and you know, there needs to be a sort of clear line. Now, I've got a little bit of an understanding of both. I haven't got a massive understanding, but there needs to be a line, doesn't there, between two, because one could, you know, it could be damaging potentially without wanting to sound, you know, disrespectful.
Yeah. You see, the funny thing is that you hardly hear about kosher in the public. All you hear about is halal. And it's just, I think Muslims have taken the bashing for a long, long time. And people Muslims are easy. It's easy to sort of take your anger on Muslims and just leave anybody. So the difference between kosher and halal is kosher, none of the kosher slaughter is stunned, is slaughtered with all of them. They don't accept stunning at all. They believe stunning is inconsistent with their rules. But the majority of halal is stunned. So that's the difference. But halal still takes the bashing from the public.
And there, I think it's because this is something I think personally, and looking at how people talk on social media and publicly, especially with other things going on in the world, when you compare kosher and halal, it's easy to jump on the Islamophobic side of things because that's been happening for ages. But kosher, because it's with the Jewish religion, anything you say, even if it's questioning, you're seen as anti-Jewish religion, and you quickly get condemned for that. Because I've asked this question before: why do we not hear about kosher slaughter? That happens. We know it's non-stun, but no one talks about it. Whereas if you mention halal anyway, like Neil says, straight away, people raise their eyebrows. People say, "Oh, you can't do that." And I think, for me, from a farmer's perspective, the whole thing of slaughtering an animal with respect and all sorts, for me, the animal experiencing pain. And I know studies have been done. Like you had a guest, at the great Temple Grandin on your podcast hour.
Yeah.
And I know tests have been done on how you can slaughter an animal without stunning. And they've checked the speed you can do it at, how it affects the carotid veins, whether the brain is still conscious or not. And I think for me, as a farmer, and this is ignoring everything else, just as a farmer that doesn't care about anything else but their animals, why should I look after an animal for sheep, let's say 5-6 months, if it's a hogget, it will be over a year, a cow, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Why should I spend all that time looking after an animal? If you get sick, I'll get it treated. I don't want to see the animal suffering whatsoever. And yet 10, 20 seconds of its last bit of its life, I can't take care to take pain from it or take pain away from it. That's the bit I don't understand. And I think the fact that halal slaughter is making ways to still fulfill the religious needs that its consumers need, but also catering for the animal's welfare, whereas the other one we're talking about, kosher, I don't know whether there's any studies being looked into how they can alleviate animal from experiencing pain, because they do experience pain, let's be honest.
That's a difficult question. If I'm speaking from official perspective, from HDB's perspective, collect levies from any animal that is slaughtered in the UK. So we can't, maybe you can comment on the welfare aspect. I cannot comment. I cannot try to denigrate one slaughter over the other.
Yeah.
But we always try to improve the slaughter process. We always, so for the non-stun slaughter, there are ways to improve it. There are ways to improve it. So for instance, let's just look at the science. If you look at small ruminants, for instance, small ruminants, they have all their blood vessels in the front of the neck. The carotid and the jugulars are here. So we know the carotid artery will take blood from the heart to the brain, and the jugular veins will take deoxygenated blood back to the rest of the body. Now, because they are both here, if you have a very sharp knife and you cut it in a very swift manner, you disconnect the blood from moving in both directions because you cut both the carotid and the jugular veins. So you disconnect the blood. However, there will still be some residual blood in the brain that will keep the animal sensible for a few seconds. And research has shown that in terms of small ruminants, when you slaughter them without stunning, they can still feel the pain between 4 and 20 seconds. I know 4 seconds. Some people may say, oh, that is too small, or the duration is very short. But an animal being in pain for 4 seconds, it still counts. But as I said, I have to present a fact. I have to present the facts without getting emotional and taking.
No, I think you make a really good point there about putting it across. And obviously, you can't. You work by HDB, and like you rightly say, you know, they're collecting their levies across all animals. I just think it would be really. I think one of the. I'm not a marketing person at all, but I think from a point of view of marketing, you know, halal meat, these sort of facts need to be really put out there, you know, because when you speak to people about it, they are still convinced of, oh, there you go, and it's just a slice of the knife type affair. And I think these facts really need putting kosher to one side because it's not a compare and contrast. I think what's important is to concentrate on halal, and that's why we've asked you on here. And I think, you know, the figures that you put out there in terms of how many, you know, the number of, you know, mutton and lamb that goes into that market is massive. And that's what, you know, UK farmers, and, you know, I'm not involved in the sheep industry in any way, but you need to, you know, this is a market that just absolutely needs to be maximised. You know, and obviously, the Muslim population in this country is growing. That market is only going to get bigger. And obviously, you know, what you're talking there, going back about spending money on meat, you know, I always have, you know, we've got a situation in the UK where people, you know, I was in the supermarket on Saturday, and I'm grabbing a few bits. Well, I never buy meat from a supermarket. I've got a fantastic butcher around the corner, Hank's Meat and Game. Give him a shout out. He's brilliant. You know, really locally sourced, all great stuff. And I'm looking at this woman, and she's there looking at this piece of lamb that's, you know, cellophane wrapped, probably been shipped from New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I'm looking, and I felt like tapping her on the shoulder, saying, "Do you know what? You want to put that around it? You go like 150 yards around the corner. There's a butcher shop there.
Yeah.
That will probably sell you a piece of lamb for a very similar amount of money, and it'd be the best lamb you've ever eaten. You know. And but it's not. It's that whole, I don't know." That's a whole different discussion, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy you mentioned population growth. That is another area that is supporting the halal market. So even without population growth, Muslims consume a lot of meat. Now, if you take the population into account, the population of Muslims is expanding at a rate greater than the non-Muslim, the general population. And also, if you break it down, they are relatively younger than the general population. So I'll give you an example. Between 2011 and 2021, the population of England and Wales expanded by 3.52 million. So 3.5 million over 10 years. Out of that 3.52, Muslims accounted for 1.16 million. That is a growth of 33% of the Muslim population. Far, far greater. So 33%. So we also know they are younger, they've got higher disposable income, they consume a lot of meat. So all these numbers, if you are a farmer and you are not excited by it, you'll never get excited.
That's why I say there is that issue there of the misinformation and some sort of social barrier there. Yeah. And I think like conversations like this, like I've seen, like you've been all over the place, and I've been calling you Mr. Worldwide, going to the Middle East and even back home, like I saw you in West Africa. And I think even visiting all these remote towns, getting farmers in the town hall or whatever, give them some, I don't know, sausage and mash or something, just get them down there and just having, because these figures you're talking about here, like 62% and that £28, like, what farmer shouldn't Like they actually light up at that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a question I was going to ask you that I think it's gone. Do you think? Do you think like the assurance schemes? Because a lot of farmers and supermarkets work with these assurance schemes, whether people like them or not. Yeah. Do you think they can do some bits to promote halal?
Yes, if they could use, so I'm not going to mention any assurance because I don't want to be biased towards any assurance. But if any assurance, say, let's say Flavian Assurance Limited, you are a farm assurance and you decided to support the halal market and just add a bolt-on module. So all you need to do is, okay, if they are coming to farm to do auditing around animal welfare, I'll add a bit of halal. And halal on the farm, all we're looking for is what type of feed are the animal being fed? How are they managed on site? So if the welfare is good, the feed hasn't got any animal derivatives. And I know in this country, ruminants are not supposed to be fed on animals anyway. So that complies on its own. So if they could bolt it on and say, look, we need to tick these boxes when we are on farm. We need to tick these boxes when we are in an abattoir. That could add a lot of value. But I don't think any of these guys have thought of adding halal just to add value to what they are doing.
Yeah,
no, I want to say something. Can I just show you something that this is a picture. I don't know whether you can see it properly. This is a picture of British lamb that was taken in Dubai just this morning. If you look closely, the price is 225 UAE pound, UAE currency, which is the dirhams.
That is
British lamb, halal lamb being sold in an export market for our farmers. 225 dirhams is around 48 pounds. That is 48 pounds per kilo that our products are being sold in Dubai. And that's halal.
Wow.
So that apart from the domestic market, that is the export market as well.
No, that's really fascinating. It'd be amiss of me, whilst we've got you on here, just to talk about the goat meat market in the UK. Yep. Obviously, it's a growing market, and again, very popular with the Muslim sort of community. One issue we have is competing with imports. When I say the price to various different potential customers, they balk at it because of cheap imports from often frozen from Spain. And I asked them, "Oh, well, is it halal?" And they say, "Oh, well, I was told it was halal." Oh. But I just wondered on imports, is there anything? Any sort of checks, or is there anything that could be done or is being done to make sure that what the Muslim community here are eating is halal? Or is it literally just you could put a sticker on it and say that it was halal?
Unfortunately, there are no checks that are being done on products that are coming into the UK to testify or to attest their halal status. Because of this, I actually wrote a paper on this some years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, on fraud in the halal market. And you'll be surprised to see the number of people that have been prosecuted for intentionally buying non-halal products and just sticking a label on it. So, and that has got something to do with maybe importation or even domestic production. So as a farmer, we know there's market for goat meat within the Muslim community. So as a farmer, if there's a way you could market your products directly to the consumer, because the younger Muslim consumer is looking for assurance to make sure that the product is halal, so they are happy to spend more on local products to just make sure it meets their religious requirements and also quality. So the quality and assurance are two important things. There are some consumers who are happy to just buy cheap imports, but there are others, if you can model your products well, you can actually maximize a lot of value. I know one farmer in the south of England, he has been able to market his products directly to the consumer. And he is expanding. Anytime I speak to him, he said, look, we're building a new cutting facility. We're doing this. We're expanding this. Because he's been able to sell it directly to them. He's been able to market it as an assured product. When I say assured, there's no certification needed, but assurance by the farmer that the products are from this farm. I know the farm. The products are slaughtered here. I know where they are slaughtered. And they are cut here. I know the butchery where they are cut. That level of assurance is very important for the Muslim community.
So the Muslim community are very, very keen to know where their foods come from.
Absolutely. That is very important.
That's really interesting.
Because of the cost of living crisis, there will be some proportion of the community just looking for cheap products. So whether it's imported, they just want a halal sticker on it. And that is where the corruption, the fraud comes in. Some processes, some sellers will intentionally sell non-halal products just with a stamp and say, look, this product is halal. It is happening. They've prosecuted so many people around the UK.
I think that I saw this firsthand when I did a market in Brixton last year. And the number of times, and I've done markets in other places which don't have that high flow of people from the Muslim community. And the number of times people are asking, because I had goat, lamb and pork separate, made it clear. And obviously I had friends there. So I had friends touching the pork and I had gloves when I was doing the lamb and goat.
Yeah.
And the first question to be asked, is it halal? You say yes. It's like, okay. What do you feed them? What do they eat? Like the goats said, they just walk around and eat on the farm. And then added another phrase I've had used, tayyib, which is about
safety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wholesomeness. And as you say there, Neil, it seems like we've got a community here, the Muslim community, because a lot of the foods eaten at home, like even like during Ramadan and Iftar, my auntie's a Muslim and saw her growing up, even though it's in Kenya, a lot of stuff is cooked from scratch.
Correct.
So if you're going to cook from scratch, you're going to have a look at the where the food comes from, the spices and all sorts of stuff. So I think even comparing another issue farmers are struggling with at the moment is trying to get the consumer to understand where their food comes from and telling that story. We're dealing with a customer here that they've already done their job for us, or that job's already been done. Someone's coming to you saying, right, okay, I want this, I want this, I want this. So again, reason number 1,000, why we should be catering for the halal market there.
Yes, so let me just add something. You see, due to the negativity around halal, we do just forgo or we just overlook some very important aspects of halal meat production. So traceability is very important, as you mentioned. The other thing is environmental sustainability. It is very, very important in halal food production. So Muslims believe, and it is in the Quran, that God created the earth in an equilibrium. So equilibrium means everything that God left for us. So the natural resources, water, plants, and all that are supposed to be in equilibrium. And we are advised that if we use those resources wisely, if we don't pollute our water bodies, if we don't overgraze our lands, if we don't deforestate the land, if we don't cause land degradation, because God presented it in that manner to us, if we can manage it well, we will be able to feed future generations. But if we violate any of God's rules and pollute the environment, do all the nasty things to the environment, tomorrow our children will not be able to find food. And on the day of judgment, when we die, Muslims believe that on the day of judgment, if you violate the rules of the equilibrium nature of the natural environment, God will punish you on the day of judgment. It's a very, very important thing. But because of the negative, we focus too much on slaughter. We forget all the positives around halal.
And even interestingly there, because we're in a society now that a lot of people are secular, don't have a religion, atheism or whatever, which is fine. People can do whatever they want to do. But when you look at it from that point there, that environmental sustainability, everyone's bleating about environmental sustainability now. And in all my, some brief, some deep reading on at Halal side, you don't see that environmental sustainability mentioned. And aside from the fact that, like I say, if people don't want to focus on the religious side, just look at the simple bits there which marry up. Like, we've got SFI now talking about environmental sustainability. You've got a group of people or religion that follows that. Again, I'm struggling to find reasons not to for farming not to cater to this market seriously, not just during like during Eid.
Yeah, and as I said, look, we need to all look at it positively. We have to look at it with an open mind. We have to be objective to Muslims. I gave you the example with the grace. If a Christian is sitting here to eat and says, "Thank God for the food provided," it will be fine if you sat in the restaurant. But if a Muslim says, "Bismillah," and start to eat, everybody will be like, "What the hell is going on?" But yes, it's the same. It's the same thanks we are giving to God. But the Muslim, everybody will look at it to be something funny. But it's not. It's just the same thing the Christian did. Yeah, the grace. Yeah. That's the same thing the Muslim is doing.
Would it be a benefit to the UK halal consumers if there was a sort of pronounced sort of certification or stamp that was, like you said, it'd be an easy add-on because most farmers are already doing that. And to cover off the slaughter, that, like you said, such a high proportion of lambs are already having, that could sort of safeguard farmers to that, UK farmers to that market, and also give halal consumers peace of mind. That really is a big thing coming out of this conversation for me. That does sort of, spark definite opportunity for growth there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's important to add that there are halal certification bodies in the UK, but they normally just focus on the point of slaughter. They don't go to the farm to see what is going on. They don't do transportation assurance. All they do is slaughter assurance. So if we could get something that would cover the entirety of the life, a holistic system, I think that would be better.
Because that could be done easily with the animal wealth and the animal wealth pathway visits that have been by a vet. That could be an easy add-on and tick from that vet.
Yeah.
That could then tie in sort of full traceability, could add quite a lot to the supply chain.
Yeah,
because I think also with that with the Taib aspect of it, I've always assumed that Taib should start from the far, even from an animal being born, really, because surely if an animal has experienced, let's say, 50% of his life has been non-Taib, surely killing it in the best possible way to make it halal doesn't qualify as Taib. Or am I understanding it wrong?
No, you are understanding it right. A Taib should apply from the day the animal is born till the time is slaughtered, and then the meat, it should apply to the meat as well. So what is fed to the animal is very important. But as I said, there are certifiers, but they don't have the resources to cover everything. So if there is a way the UK could implement something that is holistic, so that any halal meat that gets to your table, you know that this halal meat has gone through a proper auditing system from the time the animal was given, was born, till the time the product gets to your table.
I think so.
I've just sat quiet and listened to all of that. Yeah. So I'm sort of, time's wrapping up. So basically, what you're saying, halal meat, it's, you know, the way it's slaughtered, it is slaughtered in a humane way. The animal is stoned, but the animal is unconscious but still alive. The consumer is growing and getting bigger and bigger all the time. The consumer is spending more money on meat than the rest of the population. And the consumer actually wants locally produced sustainable food.
Yeah.
That just sounds perfect to me. Like, why are we not just getting behind this more and absolutely pushing it? Because it's a huge, you know, it's a big market now. It's a market that's only going to get bigger. So really, there needs to be some serious effort from the people who have the resources there to actually get out and do it. And all it would take would be like a major supermarket brand actually just to get behind it and say, look, this is what we're doing. This is what is it, and bring it into the, you know, because the majority of people get their food information from the supermarket, and they need to, if it only takes a supermarket to get involved with it and say, this is what we're doing. This is this fantastic product. You know, forget about all your worries and all the stuff that you think's wrong with it, actually, because it's true. I just think we're just missing a trick here.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, it needs some government involvement at some point in terms of regulation, because Australia, the Ministry of Primary Industries is involved. Australia and New Zealand, they are the ministries of primary industries are involved in regulating the halal. So we just need a bit of help from the top, and we all need to contribute to it. Farmers, everybody needs to realize the importance of the market, and then see if the people who make the right decisions can support the regulation of it.
I think there's definitely some light at the end of the tunnel, even though it's a flicker. Because looking at, like you did an article recently on Farmers in Farmers Weekly, a mainstream farming magazine, about the halal market. You spoke at Oxford Farming Conference this year as well. And I think, us talking about it here, and I hope it's going to encourage more conversation in future. Even seeing restaurants like Nando's, there are Nando's branches that do halal, KFC, Subway. So, yeah, I think it's like the way the world is going now, it's 2024. We should just be in a situation where as many people as possible are catered for. That just makes life easy for everyone, in my opinion. So, yeah. Look, we don't want to take...
Just a last bit there. I know prices are up, are high now. People are complaining that, look, land prices are going crazy. But the Muslim community has been experiencing this, and the general population are not aware of this. So during Qurbani last year, we paid, on average, £300 for lamb carcasses for Qurbani. £300. Wow. If you ask the general consumer, maybe the general consumer hasn't done this for a long time, but we do it. And that also explains the fact that a Muslim is prepared to pay a premium for products if it meets their religious requirement, because assurance is very, very important. So I think, look, anybody listening to this, whether you are in government, whether you are a politician, whether you are somebody who is involved in policy, the halal market needs proper discussion. And we need to be objective. I always say we need to look at the numbers. We need to be objective. We shouldn't politicize it. We shouldn't be scared to get involved in the discussion. And it is something that is supporting the UK economy. We should come to the table and see how we can support the market.
And rather than relying on two spikes in the year during the two Ramadans and whatever, you can have a stable all throughout the year. Because if you're paying £300, like there's farmers that would bite your hand off for that.
Yeah. The export market, I just showed you the price in Dubai. It's huge. So domestic export is a growing market.
Go on, Chris.
No. I was just saying that I would take the £300.
Yeah, I would too, to be fair.
What do we get for a goat? Just could sway it.
I'll do you one for £295.
Yeah, I'll buy a goat off you.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on, man. And I've got a bit of paper here written, much stuff written I've learned this evening.
Yeah, it's really good.
I hope our listeners learn something too, and it starts a conversation. I think in future it'd be good to see, let's say this time next year, whether anything's changed, or once this spike of of high lamb prices and mutton prices drops, you'll see where the farmers will start rethinking at caging for the halal market and not just waiting for two times in a year. That's the only time you hear some of these farmers mention Ramadan or Kobani. So, yeah, thank you so much, Ryan. And hopefully the rest of your Ramadan is good.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers.